Just look at this. I know a guy, he was born in 1919. His name was Ross Bagdasarian. And he had a son. And that son, I don't know, reached his 20s or 30s sometime around 1980. That's really the answer to the question, why was the Chipmunk movie released in 1987? Or was it 88? It was because, you know, that was when the heir to the Chipmunk fortune suddenly came of age and said, here's my chance to make my fortune in the world, to make my name in the world, and, well, my best asset, my ace in the hole, is probably the fact that my dad did the Chipmunks. Now it's my turn. It's kind of a sad story behind all that, because he ended up selling the rights to the Chipmunks to Universal, home of Woody Woodpecker and all kinds of other movies and theme parks across America. And what ended up happening was that they just sat on it. And he's like, no, you're going to make like a big movie, make Chipmunks famous, make me rich again. I'm like, well, yeah, nah, not so much. It's 2006. We're hanging on to that property. Maybe they just snatched it up because they didn't want to have the Chipmunks competing with their stuff. So they said, as long as we own the Chipmunks, then we can just lock them in a gunny sack and no one has to worry about them ever again. And then our own properties, like Woody Woodpecker, will be very popular. So the last I heard, Ross Bagdasarian Jr. was suing Universal Studios for not living up to the promises they'd filled his eyes with about a second Chipmunk movie. So his glory days were probably 1987, the time the Chipmunk Adventure movie was released. This is a lot easier than I thought it would be. I mean, I kept saying, I'm just going to have faith in myself and just talk and all that, but I didn't really mean that. Although, as it turns out, with the microphone in front of me, I actually am able to do that. I mean, it really is as easy as I was pretending it was about a half hour ago. The record company initially printed the labels on green backgrounds, but it sold so quickly that they ran out of green. And then they switched to black. And then they ran out of black, and they switched to blue. And then they ran out of color, and so they switched to white. And then some days they sold as many as like 500,000 records within like a day. And so then they ran out of trucks to deliver the records. And so then they used vans, and these big vans were driving around with Chipmunk records full of them. And then they ran out of vans, so then they started using station wagons, and it was so overwhelmingly popular that it was sold not just in record stores, but also like lingerie shops, cigar stores, flower stores. I mean, that's how popular the Chipmunk record was. That's why I like the Chipmunks, actually. Is they didn't worry about anything, you know. I mean, Dave Seville, right? He was always yelling. And, you know, when you're a kid, right, you're always getting in trouble, you know, nothing makes any sense. You're always being told, no, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Alvin, on the other hand, you know, you'd yell at him, Alvin, you know, what are you doing? And he would just kind of like giggle and keep on doing it. I mean, he was fearless. He really was a hero to me when I was four. Now, I was going to tell you, my favorite episode of Chipmunks, there was this one time, I don't know what it was, I was 4 years old, I was flipping channels, and I stumbled across this cartoon, yay, a cartoon, and it was Alvin and the Chipmunks. And I, right when I tuned in, what had happened was somehow David Seville was hanging upside down from the ceiling with his foot caught in one of those little noose traps. And he's yelling and screaming, saying, Alvin, you know, get me down from here. And Alvin, he just didn't give a fuck. He's like, oh, no, hang on, there's the telephone, I'll be right back. And Alvin's, Dave is dangling from the ceiling there, and then Alvin picks up the phone, and he's like, Alvin, get me down from here. And then Dave says, what, Dave Seville? Oh, no, I'm sorry, he's all tied up at the moment. I'm 4 years old, and I'm getting the jokes, you know? And so it ultimately culminates that he says, Dave, they want you on the telephone. He's like, Alvin, come on, get me down from here. Would you cut the line? Would you friggin' cut the line? So Alvin takes a pair of scissors and slices the phone in half. And I was like, man, he's gonna get in trouble for that. Anyways, I was always walking around on eggshells when I was four, you know, worried I was going to get in trouble, right? But Alvin, that's all he did was get in trouble, and he didn't worry about it. And that's why Alvin was a hero to me. So my whole life, that really meant something to me. The other big rant I have about Alvin is that sometime in the, it was 1985, I'd just gotten out of college and whatnot, and I was drifting around trying to find a job or something I wanted to do. And there was this Chipmunk Christmas special, a new one, done by his son, Ross Bagdasarian Jr. And it's the freakiest plot you've ever seen, that Alvin and Chipmunks all of a sudden wake up one day and say, wait a minute. Dave is not our biological father. There must be some Chipmunk mother out there that gave birth to us and then left us. And so they packed up their bags and they just left. Dave comes home and there's like an empty room. The Chipmunks are gone. They're out of there. They're going back to the woods. I want to believe it was some woods in Pennsylvania. It was probably Yosemite. I mean, they didn't really spell it out, but these Chipmunks go off to the woods, and I don't know how. They do genealogy research, but they actually track down the the mother chipmunk was their biological their the parent, and they're all happy. And that night they all she's got little spectacles. She's like your typical sweet grandma chipmunk. They're very happy, and I have no idea where this was going to go, how it was going to end, right? But they're in the tree all snuggly, and then Alvin says Alvin still making trouble. He says, you know. She abandoned us. You know that guy? She just dissed us. She just left us on the doorstep of this human and then walked off and left us with no chipmunk love whatsoever. And they, it was getting all angsty. It was like this chipmunk psychodrama. So the other chipmunks say, Alvin, don't make waves here. Come on, we finally got a home, a chipmunk mom. Why can't you just let it be? Why do you always got to make trouble, Alvin? Why? You're going to screw up a good thing here. But the very next day, there's this big chill-type confrontation where he says to his mother, if you loved us, why did you leave us alone like that? Why? Why did you abandon us? And I was thinking, what the fuck kind of Christmas special is this, man? So, I don't know. And she gave a sort of a generic answer that they'd probably run past a focus group. She says, well, as a single mother, I knew I wouldn't be able to give you a good home, and so I wanted to make sure that you were adopted by somebody who could give you the kind of life that you deserved. And someone pointed out that this is probably the kind of thing that, I don't know, adopted children have to deal with in real life, at least some. You know, you always have to wonder, you know, why was I adopted? What happened to my parents? Was there something wrong with me? So here we were, the chipmunks, putting out this sort of weird adoption psychodrama. After that, they always seem pretty angsty to me. Every time I look at the pictures, there's a moment with the glasses, you know, trying so hard, like perfectionist chipmunk. And then there's the cute one trying so hard to be lovable. But really, they're from a dysfunctional family. It's a broken family. They're trying so hard, and I don't know. And Alvin is, of course, the one that acts out. I mean, those are three classic traits of a dysfunctional family. It's very disturbing. Yeah, it was funny because in the 50s, the chipmunks got really huge. I mean, incredibly huge. I was talking before about how they sold in 7 weeks 4.5 million copies of the Chipmunk Christmas Song. No piece of vinyl had ever sold that quickly in the history of humankind. 4.5 million copies. I mean, you would get a gold record at 500,000. So that's like 9 gold records all rolled into one. And what's wild about that is that 2 years earlier, I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to look at that. I mean, we all know about the chipmunks, and we know nothing about this guy, Ross Baghdadzerian. You'd watch the chipmunk cartoon show, and then they'd say, a Ross Baghdadzerian production. I thought that was just some made-up word, but it actually was this guy's name. He was Armenian-American. He grew up in Fresno. And that's the other thing. I went on the web. I tried to find out, who is this Ross Baghdadzerian guy? I went to Wikipedia, and I went to the official Chipmunk History website, thechipmunks.com/history.php. It's just so weird that exists, you know, thechipmunks.com. Here we are in the 21st century. Who would have thought? But piecing it all together, you get like maybe 5, 10, 12 facts about the life of Ross Baghdadzerian, and then in your head you just kind of have to fill in the rest. He was born in 1919. He was in his 20s when World War II came. He was stationed in Spain, in the town of Seville, which he liked quite a bit. This comes up later on. He had tiny, tiny parts in Hollywood movies. Like, he was in the movie Stalag 17. It's about POWs. He was the singing POW. His name does not appear in the credits. That's pretty much about it. His cousin was a famous Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, William Saroyan. And I think they were on a cross-country car trip, or maybe I just made that up and imagined it. But they were driving across America, and they that's how I picture it. Anyhow, somehow these two men co-wrote a song together, and it was the first big hit of Rosemary Clooney. And the song was "Come On to My House, My House to Come On," and I think it sold, I don't know, like a million copies. But it's weird because it's such a stupid song. I have no idea what the concept for it was. Let's do a song where instead of singing in, you know, perfect English, the song is in kind of a dialect, and there's like a harpsichord in the background. It's the fact that it was probably strange back then, and now that it's 60 years old, it's even stranger now. I think 1951. So he has this one hit. He has these small parts in movies. He has a midlife crisis, maybe. Who knows? But he hits his 40s. It's 1958. He's got $200 to his name. He's got three kids. He's going to die 13 years later. Yeah, we know now in hindsight. So what does Ross Baghdadzarian do? Well, he takes the $200 and he blows it on a tape recorder. I kind of admire that, because that's the kind of crazy faith and geekness that you know, we all aspire to today, and that's kind of what he did, right? I mean, he's like, well, I don't know, $200 won't last forever, but maybe I can find some way to parlay that into, I don't know. If you read the official Chipmunk website for the history of this man, written by his son, he says that basically my dad was fueled by sheer panic. He's now got $10 to his name on a tape recorder on his desk. He's looking around his office, looking for inspiration. And there was a book on his desk called Duel with a Witch Doctor. Takes himself singing. This incredible song. I was in love with you. And then the witch doctor, he told me what to do. He said that. That's pretty much the whole song right there. What's weird is that it goes on for about 3 minutes, but it more or less just repeats the same thing. I found out something really weird this weekend. I took the song and I slowed it down to half speed. And it's weird because, it sounds really wild to hear the song slow. But on top of which, you recognize the voice of the guy saying, I told the witch doctor, that's Dave Seville, and then you recognize the Chipmunk voice. But if you slow it down to half speed, you get one new voice and not two. If you slow it down to half speed, you get a real slow voice in place of Dave Seville's voice. But then the witch doctor voice becomes Dave Seville, just saying, ooh-ee, ooh-ah-ah. Ooh-ee, ooh-ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. Ooh-ee, ooh-ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bang-bang. And that's his entire career in 10 seconds right there, that he took his voice and he would speed it up. And next thing you know, you've got a Chipmunk voice. Or at least classic. It sounds weird enough that you can sell a million records. And it was like having a genie in a bottle. All of a sudden he's like, huh, you know, I've been doing songs, writing songs for Rosemary Clooney, getting bit parts in movies, nothing happens. And then, you know, I put it on double speed and I sell a million copies. So nobody knows what he did for the rest of that year. But the story goes that they didn't even want to release the Witch Doctor song, but he said to them, look, you're about to go out of business, so what do you got to lose? And so they released it, and then it sold a million copies, and they said, can you do that again? I don't know what he did in that year. You know, what would I do? What would anybody do? I bet at some point you say to yourself, maybe I should do that thing where I speed up the voices to something really fast again. Maybe that's what I should do. So time passes, and he ends up, you know, pulling together the Chipmunk song, the Christmas song, which was the one that sold so many copies. 4.5 million copies in 7 weeks. No song had ever sold that many. They ran out of ink for the labels. It was hugely popular. And the story behind that goes that he was driving around Yosemite one day, and this chipmunk leaped out on the road. And he's a nice guy. He hits the brakes and doesn't want to run over the chipmunk. And then instead of scampering, the chipmunk just stands there, like, nah, I'm not afraid of you in your car. The legend goes that that's how he got the idea for having one chipmunk who just stood there and wasn't afraid of anything that Dave Seville did. You know, it's weird. If you ever met Ross Baghdadzarian and you handed him a record and said, hey, could I have your autograph? He wouldn't sign it Ross Baghdadzarian. He'd sign it Dave Seville. And it was all because he'd been stationed in Seville, Spain during World War II. He had fond memories of that. We don't really know what they were. We just know that World War II, he was in Spain, and, you know, 10 to 15 years later, he decides to call himself Dave Seville.
Used to live in a cozy hole under a tree on the west side. But then we met Dave Seville. He changed our lives forever. He took us into his home and raised us as his own children. We traveled around the world, entertaining children with our shows and albums. We used to ride in limos and eat caviar and designer walnuts. We were on top of the world. But there's another side of this story, one that no one knows. We did coke, drank bottles of Jack, fucked underage women, both white and black. And in my prime, when I was a star of shine, I get fucked up at parties, man, all the time. We hung out with Sean Penn, Nicholson, and Ren 10-10, Lassie out, and Benji every now and then.
Yeah, now see, when you say beatniks or jazz to anybody right now, you know, they're thinking, I don't know, I gotta know what jazz is. They used to play that in my junior high school band. Why? Well, what's the big deal? But it was a big deal in the 50s. I mean, jazz was heroin. Jazz was people dropping out of society. And Norman Mailer wrote this huge essay about how the only wise thing to do in a world where there's a nuclear bomb is to just drop out, man, to just live in the moment, because who knows, we could all be blown away tomorrow. And people were afraid of jazz. They thought that it went along with this whole radical lifestyle. They were afraid of rock and roll, too, for that matter. People were afraid of a lot of things in the 50s. Subversion and whatnot. And so jazz was a demonic music. I don't know. We don't understand it today. I just don't understand what the big deal was about jazz in the 50s. But, yeah, so you ended up with Dave Seville doing sort of your very, very family-friendly Christmas songs. And then when the first songs you had the Chipmunks singing were Three Blind Mice and Old MacDonald Had a Farm. And that was his idea. Now, meanwhile, back in New York, there was a guy named Don Elliott. He'd spent his whole life doing jazz. I mean, he went to high school with some famous jazz man. Anyway, when he was in the Army, he was in a band with Chet Baker. And then he went into the biggest names in orchestral music, Harry Shearing and George Shearing and Harry James. And then on and on, he recorded an album with the jazz pianist, Bill Evans, in 1956. So he had done all kinds of jazz. He was serious about jazz, and it was driving him crazy that it was still this sort of fringe music that was finding its audience, but that people just would not accept jazz. That jazz never seemed to find the popularity that the jazz aficionados thought it deserved. And you know, how much does it hurt? You pull open the paper, you read the newspaper, you go to a record store, and you hear the news. Hey, did you hear that the Chipmunk record just sold 4.5 million copies?
Alvin, stop shooting that gun. Alvin, will you put that gun down?
Yeah, see, ultimately, it's the Chipmunks themselves with a sort of false wholesomeness that they try and rally the entire planet around. That's the real threat of society. I mean, jazz was this idea that you'll be faithful to your own impulses and you'll groove on your own wildness. And ultimately, that's a more sustaining and a more meaningful model. And I think, you know, now we're not afraid of jazz or rock and roll. That's pretty much the standard. That's what you hear when you're on hold talking to your insurance company. And where is Old MacDonald? Where are the big bands? So ultimately they lost that war, but not without putting up a good fight. So this guy, Don Elliott, was listening, and David Lynch used to do a cartoon called The Angriest Dog in the World. And it was always three panels of a dog straining against its chain, and it would say the same thing at the top of the strip every day. This dog is so mad, so angry at the world that it can't move. It just stands there, frozen in anger, every second, every hour of the day. And the entire comic strip would be three panels of this dog frozen with anger, not moving. And then every day, David Lynch would call in a new caption for the middle panel. One more thing that would make the dog even madder. The first panel, the dog is really angry. In the second panel, did you know the Chipmunks sold 4.5 million copies of the record? And then the third panel, the dog is still really angry. It's kind of like that. There's this guy, Don Elliott, and you're going through life wondering why jazz isn't popular, and someone says, hey, did you know the Chipmunks sold 4.5 million copies of their Christmas record? It's just one of those little factoids that would make you snap, you know? Bill Evans is a famous jazz pianist, and Don Elliott's out there, and they're in their hipster New York recording studios, trying so hard to keep the candle burning, trying to get people to understand just how cool jazz was, doing songs and music and whatnot. As time goes on, Dave finally realized that, you know, if you want to have popular success, maybe we ought to try. We can do jazz. He's a quality jazz man. He knows his jazz. He had such a pedigree, so much talent, so much musical ability. So he brought in his friend Cannonball Adderley and actually did an album where he would scat in a Chipmunk voice. I love it because he's probably one of the most famous alto saxophone players in the history of jazz. And here he is jamming with chipmunks, or squirrels, I guess, in this case. And what's even worse is it's a great track.
Hey,
It's like they're having some kind of duel, the chipmunk and the saxophone player. And so I got to think, I know nothing about Don Elliott. He's one of those lost voices. I got to think, if you could slow down the Cannonball Adderley singing squirrel track, then you could actually hear the scat solo that he was doing. And the amazing thing about that was that even when you play Cannonball Adderley at half speed, he's still going pretty fast. That's how good that guy was, that even at half speed, he's still hitting all the notes. I mean, he could keep up with those kids. So, ultimately, it came down to a war. Well, who was going to win, the chipmunks or the squirrels? Jazz or Old MacDonald? And the squirrels came out of the gate fast. When David Seville appeared on Ed Sullivan's show with the chipmunks, they didn't have any cartoons, so he just used like a hand puppet. These are the chipmunks. Look at them, the hand puppet. Chipmunk hand puppet. It was kind of lame. Nobody went for that. And they wanted to do a cartoon, but they were having a hard time getting the look right. I mean, on the first Chipmunk album, it's kind of scary. They've got big, sharp, pointy teeth. His son said, it was like they've got to give you rabies if they bit you. They were scary. They were creepy. They were ugly. And yeah, they had the cute little voices, but they didn't look cute and cuddly. So they were in the studio in Hollywood. David Seville was lining up these deals, trying to get the chipmunks to be TV stars. Meanwhile, the squirrels were gaining on him. The Nutty Squirrels was the name of Don Elliott's band with his partner, Sasha Berlin, who was like an ad jingle man. He wrote the Alka-Seltzer theme and the theme of What's My Line. And now you had two competing rodent bands out there in the late 50s. Who's going to win? I heard later on that David Seville actually sued somebody else who tried the same trick. Like, no one else can speed up recorded music like that, because that will sound like the chipmunks, and I own the chipmunks. But I don't know whatever happened to the squirrels. They seem to actually hold their own, and they got to TV first. Believe it or not, although we've all known and at least seen what Alvin and the Chipmunks looked like, if you were living in 1960, there were no chipmunks on TV. There was only the Nutty Squirrels. And people didn't really like them. That was what's sad about this. They came out of the gate. They sounded great. The chipmunks had the same problem. They had these hyperactive chipmunks. They're really cute. But what do you do? So what you ended up with is that you had like TV stations that were afraid to play the Nutty Squirrel cartoon on their TV station because they said, no, man, you got that jazz thing going on. That's just too radical for our small-town TV viewers. Ironically, about 5 years later when the Beatles came to America, the Chipmunks did an album where the Chipmunks sang Beatles songs. And the Nutty Squirrels also did an album where they sang Beatles songs. Everyone was singing Beatles songs. I mean, it's basically one fad chasing another. Well, when it was all over, it was just the chipmunks. The squirrels retired themselves. Although there's a weird webpage on the internet that claims that after Ross Bagdasarian died, and sometime in the 70s, various radio DJs would take songs and speed them up to double speed and say, oh, it's another crazy chipmunk song. And someone tried to tell me that the Nutty Squirrels were owned by a guy named Ronnie Millsap. And Millsap had somehow lost the rights to the name Nutty Squirrels, but he still had the rights to that particular gimmick. And so he was releasing albums in the 70s, Melvin and Squirrely and Shirley, something like that. And even stranger, Russ Bagdasarian Jr. was thinking, well, now here's my chance to cash in on my dad's name. If everybody else is going to be doing it, why can't I do it? I'm the guy that actually owns the rights to the Chipmunks. So he released an album called Chipmunk Punk. And I remember, to promote it, they actually had to buy like ads on TV, like 30-second ads saying, the latest sensation, everybody go out and call your phones now, dial in, and order your copy of Chipmunk Punk. They'd sell like a K-Tel album, and honestly, it wasn't punk. It was new wave. You'd sing like Call Me by Blondie, things like that. But they had, you know, 12 of the least likely possible Chipmunk songs, and, you know, they sold over TV, and it made enough of a splash that it revived the Chipmunks, and there was an 80s version of the Chipmunks on TV and whatnot. But the weird story is that apparently the last remnants of the Nutty Squirrels and the outtakes from the Chipmunk Punk album were sort of folded together into some kind of gigantic Bangladesh concert or something. There's an album where the Chipmunks and the Squirrels actually appear on the same album together. First and last time, and I don't know, maybe bygones were bygones, or maybe, I mean, what are the Chipmunks for? They're a piece of intellectual property that some Hollywood fat cats own, and they just got shuffled together one day in 1970-something.